Well, today we are moving to the second lesson in our series of the question of whether the gospel message is true, which is less of study of the text and more of study about the text, that we can depend on these gospel accounts of the life of Jesus, and then kind of by extension from that, the things that Jesus believed, we would believe as well regarding the reliability of the Old Testament, and then looking forward to the coming of the rest of what we would call the New Testament, and just this basic picture of whether or not we can have confidence in these documents. Because one of the questions that you will invariably be asked by skeptics is, why do you follow that 2,000-year-old book? What is it about that that's so special? And you can say, well, I believe it came from God, and that's fantastic. It's a great thing to believe. But can you convince your neighbor across the fence of that? Is there something that you can rationally appeal to this person and say, there's a good reason to believe in this, to trust in this because X, Y, and Z, and that they would listen to you? And so last night we talked about the transmission of those documents from when they were originally written to us 2,000 years later. And that ultimately you can have great confidence that it was passed down to us accurately in spite of the amount of time that is passed down, in spite of the number of copies that have been made, in spite of even the variants that there are in the manuscripts, the differences there are in the manuscripts, and how insignificant those actually are. Well, today we're turning our focus to a different question, which has to do with the accuracy of the authors. And what we're talking about is their accuracy in detail, detail that can be verified outside the Bible. And that may or may not seem to you like an important sort of thing to talk about. I mean, obviously they need to be accurate that there was a guy named Jesus and he lived and he died and he rose from the dead. That's pretty important. But what we're going to be talking about today are a bunch of little incidental sorts of things. And you may be thinking throughout the course of this, why is that such a big deal? Why is it such a big deal that they're right about this and they're right about that and they're right about this other thing that really seems to be completely unimportant and insignificant? What's the big deal about that kind of accuracy? Well, the big deal about that kind of accuracy, I always go back and forth on whether I should let the cat out of the bag at the beginning or hold it till the end and have some suspense build up. But I don't know that that makes for great drama. I don't know that it makes for good teaching. So I'll tell you now why this is a big deal, is that frauds writing later in a different place don't get this kind of thing right. There's going to be an example that I like to use. And I'm going to have to say people who lived in France aren't allowed to participate in this. But it's the one that I always use. And so I'll come back to it. And there's no way I'm not going to say it. If I try to pick something else, I'm not going to keep it straight. So I'm going to use my usual example. Imagine that you are writing a story about France 50 years ago. How accurate can you be in the details of that story? I'll give you the internet in 3 hours. To go do as much research as you want to do. How accurate can you be in the details of that story if you're just making it up and trying to pass it off as fact? It is incredibly hard to be accurate and very easy to be wrong in detail after detail after detail. Now, if you lived in France and you're telling a story about your time of living in France, how easy is it to be right in all the details? It's a breeze. You're just telling the story. That's all you're doing. And it's a lot harder to be inaccurate if you lived through it. So ultimately, the point of all of this is to say that the gospel authors show that what they are giving us and the kind of accuracy they have, they are showing us that what they are giving us is high-quality eyewitness testimony of the life of Jesus. Because someone other than an eyewitness cannot do what they consistently do from beginning to end in a variety of different ways. And so that's what we're going to work our way through. First of all, though, I'm going to try to run through this first point quickly because I don't want to get hung up on this. There's any number of places you can look for this information. But I think it's an important thing to at least touch on. And I'll say at the outset that the PowerPoint is very bare bones tonight. So if you like to take notes based on that, I basically have my three main points up here, and that's it. So you'll need to fill out the subpoints on your own as I go. What I want to talk about first is extra-biblical historical confirmation. And that is to say things that are in the Bible that are confirmed by histories and historians outside the Bible. And you are never going to find any extra biblical source that confirms every detail of the gospel accounts. As for that matter, you're never going to find any extra Josephus source that confirms every detail of Josephus, because they're each writing their own story. They're each writing their own histories. But the more that they intersect and the more that they show themselves to be accurate in this way, the better it is for the biblical story. And as far as they overlap, these extra-biblical histories, both Jewish and Roman, and for that matter, even later Christian histories as well that aren't the Bible, confirm the basic biblical story. And so let me run through just a couple of examples of this quickly. Again, I don't want to get hung up on this. The rest of the stuff I want to talk about, to me at least, is a lot more interesting. So, Josephus, probably the most famous early historian to us, Jewish historian writing in the late first century, talks about Jesus and John the Baptist both. About John the Baptist, we find out that he was martyred at the hand of Herod Antipas, and that he was a teacher who attracted a large following. He doesn't say much about John, but that's consistent with what the Bible says about John, at least in that basic picture. About Jesus, Josephus tells us that he was a martyred leader in the church, of the church that was starting in Jerusalem, that he was a wise teacher who had established a wide and lasting following of disciples, that he was crucified when Pontius Pilate was in charge there in Jerusalem at the instigation of some Jewish leaders. So not a whole lot, but everything that he says about Jesus is consistent with the Bible. Tacitus, we talked about him last night, second century Roman senator, talks about Christianity and Jesus as well. He tells us that the spread of Christianity was based on a historical figure named Christ, is the name that he gives us. This Christ was crucified under Pontius Pilate during the reign of Tiberius Caesar, that the whole thing originated in Judea and spread all the way to Rome, so that there were vast multitudes of Christians in Rome by AD 64. Which, again, not a whole lot, but everything that it says is consistent with the Bible. Suetonius, a second century Roman historian, gives us direct confirmation, not of the Gospels, but of something in Acts, which is significant because it was written by one of the Gospel authors. And the more you can show Acts is reliable, the more you show Luke is reliable. So as a historian, he gets more credibility. The Claudius expulsion of the Jews from Rome in Acts 18, Suetonius confirms that that is true and that happened. Pliny, a second century Roman senator, tells us that Christians met regularly on a certain fixed day. That's his terminology, how he says it, which we would, I think, correlate with the first day of the week in the Bible. But he just says a certain fixed day they met and they worshiped Christ as a deity. And so already, by the time of Pliny at least, there is record outside the Bible that Jesus was considered to be a god. And that's a significant detail because you think about what skeptics like to say, and they say the Jesus story is legendary. It grew over time. You know, Jesus never actually said these things the Bible said about him, and it's kind of this fish story that gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And eventually people started worshiping Jesus as a god. Well, the problem with that is it takes time for a normal person to become a god in legendary development. That doesn't happen during that person's lifetime. That doesn't happen during the lifetime of anyone who is a witness of him and what he did. It doesn't happen during the next generation either. It takes hundreds of years for this kind of legendary development to happen about a historical figure. And so by the second century, we know that this person, who is no fan of Christians, by the way, is confirming that Jesus was worshipped as a deity, tells us that goes back a really long way. Of course, the Bible takes it back even further, but outside the Bible, it goes back to the second century. So again, we don't have the whole story, but you stop and you put all this together. This is outside the Bible. There is a person named Jesus. That's the first thing that everybody says outside the Bible, by the way. Everybody that talks about Christianity, everyone that talks about this sect of people who came out of Jerusalem and Judea, everyone, the Romans, the Christians, the Jews, all of them talk about Jesus. Here is an itinerant Jewish rabbi, this wandering preacher. He is not the kind of people historians get excited about. Historians write about kings. They write about empires. They write about wars. They don't write about wandering Jewish preachers. So the fact that he's mentioned at all in any extra-biblical history is pretty significant by itself. The fact that all of them write about him is really remarkable. And so to say, as some people today do, that Jesus never existed is to basically look all history in the face and say, I know more than you do, which is crazy. Even Bart Ehrman, the guy I mentioned last night, the high-level skeptic, even this guy, as skeptical as he is, says that anyone who says Jesus didn't exist doesn't know what they're talking about. There's some good confirmation for us right now. That kind of skeptic says that about the existence of Jesus. So they all say Jesus existed. Jesus was a Jewish teacher. Many people believed, this is outside of some of the things that we talked about, but I could have added some quotations to this. Sorry, I forgot that I left it out earlier. Many people believe that he performed healings and exorcisms. Jewish writings talk about being healed in the name of Jesus. Some people believe that he was the Messiah. He was the Christ. That's the name that's given. Messiah is the Hebrew word. Christ is the Greek word. They both mean the anointed one. Some people believe that he was the Messiah. He was rejected by Jewish leaders. He was crucified by Pilate during the reign of Tiberius. His followers believed that he was still alive, and they spread beyond Palestine all the way to Rome, where eventually the Jews were kicked out. Probably in conflict with the Christians, and people worshipped him as a god by the second century. Is that every detail of the Gospels? No. Is that a pretty good composite picture? It's not bad. That's the basic story right there. That's the main bullet points of it that are confirmed outside the Bible. So there's one thing that I think is worth noting. But what really interests me and what I want to spend most of our time talking about is the incidental details, those little things that you don't think are important, but when it comes to this, are extremely important. There's a modern apologist named J. Warner Wallace. I don't know if you've ever seen any of his work or not. He is a former cold case detective who has written a book. He's written several books now. The first one that he wrote was called Cold Case Christianity. And what he did is he takes his skill as a detective and applies it to investigating the story of Jesus and looks at evidence in that kind of light. And the sorts of things that detectives look at are those little minor details, those things that say, is this guy telling the truth or isn't he telling the truth? How does this conflict with that? How does this correlate with that? And those kinds of things. And it's a fascinating approach to the Gospels because it does some of this. What I'm doing isn't drawn from Wallace's work, although I imagine there's some overlap in what I'll do and what he does. But I want to talk about two basic things. One, I want to talk about the reliability of Acts, even though it's not the Gospels, because like I said, if Acts is reliable, that means Luke is reliable, the person Luke is reliable, which gives us confidence in the Gospel of Luke as well. And then we're going to talk about names. And this is where, to me, it gets really, really interesting. And this is information that's only been around really since the early 2000s sometime. So if you've not studied this sort of thing in the last 15, 20 years, you may never heard any of this. This may be brand new stuff for you. And that's the other thing to me about it that's exciting. It's kind of brand new sort of information. So we'll talk about names. I'll just leave that there for you to think about what on earth names could have to do with anything. Let's talk, though, about the book of Acts and the reliability of Acts as it relates to Luke as a historian. There are two significant figures who did a lot of work on this. There is, first of all, a fellow named William Ramsey. That might be a name that you recognize. I don't know, maybe not. William Ramsey was a late 19th, early 20th century archaeologist. He was an unbeliever. He did not believe in the Bible. He was not a Christian of any stripe whatsoever. He went into a study of Asia Minor, studying the history and the geography of Asia Minor, doing archaeological work there. He tells us that at the beginning of his work, he believed that Acts was not written by Luke, the traveling companion of Paul. He had bought into a notion that was very prominent in the 19th century, that all of these things were written by frauds later on, claiming names that were not the people they actually were. And so Luke, he says, or Acts, he says, he believed was a product of the second century by someone claiming to be a traveling companion of Paul, not someone who actually was a traveling companion of Paul. Now stop and think about that. Let's go back to our example of France. What do you know about France 100 years ago? Maybe that's not even easy for people that lived there, right? What do you know about France 100 years ago? How accurately can you describe the various aspects of life there? And so he says, I go into this not believing it's a product of the first century, believing that it was a product of the second century. He says, I never relied on its evidence as trustworthy for first century conditions. Which is to say, what I thought this person was telling us is what it was actually like in the second century, not what it was like in the first century. So he goes into this study, and as he walks away from it, this is what he says. And he studies a variety of things. We just don't have time to get into all the details. We're talking about locations of boundaries and landmarks and things like that, archaeological stuff, little minutiae. I'll give you some better examples of minutiae as we move forward. I just want to touch on Ramsey briefly because Ramsey is your skeptic turned believer, and that's just such a great story. Listen to this series of quotes. I may fairly claim to have entered on this investigation without prejudice in favor of the conclusions which I shall now seek to justify to the reader. On the contrary, I began with a mind unfavorable to it. It did not then lie in my line of life to investigate the subject minutely, but more recently, I found myself brought into contact with the Book of Acts as an authority for the topography, antiquities, and society of Asia Minor. It was gradually borne upon me that in various details the narrative showed marvelous truth. In fact, beginning with a fixed idea that the work was essentially a second century composition, and never relying on its evidence as trustworthy for first century conditions, I gradually came to find it a useful ally in some obscure and difficult investigations. That last part, if you didn't catch the significance of that as I was reading through it, and you're not getting to see all the words as I go, what he says is, I started by thinking it was never reliable, and in the end it got me out of a few jams. Because I had no idea what was going on until I looked at Acts. And I was like, oh, that's what's going on. This makes perfect sense now. Now that I've looked at something that is an authority, he says, for the topography, antiquities, and society of Asia Minor. He goes on to say in this same book, Luke's history is unsurpassed in respect to its trustworthiness. In a different book, Ramsey says, further study showed that the book of Acts could bear the most minute scrutiny as an authority for the facts of the Aegean world, and that it was written with such judgment, skill, art, and perception of truth as to be a model of historical statement. Now, let me put those two together for a second. Beginning with a fixed idea that the work was essentially a second century composition and never relying on its evidence as trustworthy for first century conditions, I came to discover that it was written with such judgment, skill, art, and perception of truth to be a model of how history should be written. This is the standard that historians should look to, is what Ramsey says at the end. I set out to look for truth on the borderland where Greece and Asia meet, and I found it there. There being the book of Acts. You may press the words of Luke in a degree beyond any other historians, and they stand the keenest scrutiny and the hardest treatment. Luke is a historian of the first rank. Not merely are his statements trustworthy, this author should be placed along with the very greatest of historians. I mean, to say that he changed his mind is the understatement of the year in terms of what I could say in this pulpit. I mean, here is someone who goes from not believing to being so completely blown away by the accuracy of Luke that he says it's the model of what a history should look like. Everything that he does, it can be pressed to the nth degree. And it shows itself to be true over and over again. It's absolutely remarkable, the turnaround that this man has. Well, his work was continued on by a mid to late 20th century scholar named Colin Hemer, who I doubt you've ever heard of his name. But he wants to pick up the mantle of Ramsey and continue the work of Ramsey. And he went on to write a book called The Book of Acts in the Setting of Hellenistic History is what it's called. And it's a remarkable book in a variety of ways. It's insanely expensive. So I wouldn't recommend you trying to go buy it unless you just have disposable income or you just want it for some reason and you don't care how much it costs. It's like $75 for one copy of the book, kind of expensive. So, but it does a variety of things. And one of the things that he does is he goes to the last 16 chapters of the book of Acts, where Paul is in the Mediterranean world, basically. He goes to the last 16 chapters of the book of Acts and details 84 specific facts that have been confirmed by historical and archaeological research. 84 different specific things that have been confirmed. Not someone got lucky once or twice. Someone got 84 specific things right, and those are only the ones that can be confirmed. Not everything from back then can be confirmed. Things like ports, locations of ports, names of ports, boundaries, we talked about that sort of thing already briefly a moment ago, landmarks, slang terminology, local languages, local deities, local industries, proper titles for numerous regional and local officials. So all sorts of things like that. Let me talk about two of those very quickly. First of all is the titles for different regional and local officials. This is something that probably would never cross our minds. Especially living in America, you know, you've got the same basic titles for everybody. You've got a president, you've got some senators, you've got some congressmen, you've got city council members, governors, and mayors, right? So if you're the person in charge of a city, you're the mayor. I mean, there may be a few exceptions to that around the country, but it's pretty homogenized in terms of the titles that we use for people. Well, it was not so in the first century world. There are five different titles used for five different people in five different locations in the book of Acts. And Hemer has shown us that Luke gets every single one of those right. The right title for the right person in the right place at the right time. Because those titles changed over the years as well. In fact, there was a while that the Bible was accused of being incorrect because Luke used a title for the leaders in Thessalonica that had not yet been confirmed to be a first century title. In fact, they thought there was a different first century title, and this was a second century title, the one that Luke uses. And aha, here's our proof. It's a second century author pretending to be Paul's traveling companion, only until they discovered an arch that had that title on it in the first century. And lo and behold, Luke was right after all. So again, think about this for a second. You're a second century fraud. You're trying to pass off your history as being reliable. What are the odds that you can get the governor of Cyprus, the magistrates in Philippi, the officials in Thessalonica, the chief executive magistrate in Ephesus, and the ruler of Malta, every one of those people, their title right in those, I mean, this is a pretty, from Cyprus to Malta and three other places in between, gets every single one of those titles right? He doesn't even have access to Wikipedia. How's he getting it? Well, it's really easy if you were there. It's really easy if you were there. The other one that just really boggles my mind, I don't know if you caught it as I was reading through that list, slang terminology. Did you hear that as I was going through it? It's not something that happens a lot in the Bible, but when Paul is in Athens, he's called a babbler. And the word there is a word that refers to birds. It's a seed scatterer is the word. And it originally referred to birds and how they'd pick up seeds and just kind of scatter them all over the place. And that came to be Athenian slang, not slang everywhere, slang in Athens. It came to be Athenian slang for people whose communication lacked sophistication and they would just pick up bits and pieces of information and scatter it all over the place. So that's kind of the connection of how that word came to refer to that thing. And so this was well-tested Athenian slang. And Paul's called that in Athens. Now, stop and think about this for a second. Do you know how hard it is to get slang terminology right? Yeah. Have you ever heard someone, or maybe tried yourself, to use the proper slang with your children or grandchildren and have them look at you like you've got four heads because you're 5 years off? No one calls it that anymore, Mom. No one says that anymore. It's really, really easy to get slang wrong, even if you live in that place. I mean, it's not like you're over in Spain somewhere while they're using American slang. It's just changed and you missed it. You think about the number of different words that have been used for something that's really, really good. It's been groovy. It's been hip. It's been rad. It's been gnarly. It's been cool. It's been awesome. It's been bad. It's been sick. It's been tight. It's been dope. It's been lit. It's been who knows what else. And if you use the wrong term at the wrong time, you sound like a total poser or whatever the right word for that is these days. because it changes so frequently. You know how hard it is to get the right slang in the right place at the right time? And Luke pulls it off. How do you do it? You do it because you were there. Again, these little silly sounding kinds of details are mountains and mountains of evidence that these people were there. And they're not making something up. They're writing the story and they're getting it right because they were actually eyewitnesses of the events. And that brings us to the last one. And I say last like it's about to end, but it's not. And we'll spend the most time on this, is the use of personal and place names. And this is the one that's only been around for the last 15, 20 years or so, because only recently has someone taken all the data that we have from various first and second century sources and put them into a database where people could use the information. But it turns out that from the Bible and Josephus and ossuaries, anyone know what an ossuary is? It was a very famous one a few years back, the James ossuary. So what they would do when someone died is they'd bury them in a tomb, and a year later they'd come back and collect the bones and put them in this little bone box. That's what an ossuary is. So lots of names off of ossuaries. They found all sorts of contracts and other various legal sorts of paperwork and other kinds of paperwork. And what they did is they took all of the different names from all of these different sources and put them in a big database. And they've got a big enough sample size that you can have pretty good idea of what name frequency was in the first century. What are the most common names? What are the least common names? That kind of thing. You know, you see those articles sometimes, browsing the internet or looking at a magazine in the doctor's office, the 10 most popular names in, 2018 or whatever. Well, we've got that for the first and second century. And there's some really interesting stuff going on as you think about that, because, first of all, the names weren't the same everywhere. If you look at the first century names in Palestine, where there's a large Jewish community, and the first century names in Alexandria, Egypt, where there's another large Jewish community, they're not the same list. They're very different lists based on different things that happened and based on the culture. One of the most popular names in Alexandria was Ptolemaeus. Ever heard of a Ptolemaeus? Probably not. The Ptolemies, the Greek rulers, were in Egypt, and that impacted that culture's names. Meanwhile, Judas is a very popular name, not anymore, but it was in the first century because of Judas Maccabee and what he did. And Simon was a popular name because of Simon Maccabee. And so the way that the cultures developed impacted the names. And so let's go back to France 100 years ago. Quick, tell me the 10 most popular names in France 100 years ago. Jacques and Pierre, and that's as far as I can go, and I don't know if they were popular or not. Those are just the only two French names I can come up with off the top of my head, right? That's kind of where most of us probably are in terms of coming up with French names, is we can come up with a couple. How about the seven most populous cities in France? Paris. There was a treaty somewhere. Versailles? Okay, that's about it, right? And that's as far as you can go, is just a couple, maybe. Again, I'll give you the internet in 3 hours, and you can do a little bit better. But what are the odds that you can come up with the 10 most popular names in France 100 years ago, even with a long time to research? That's tough. And so you think about this, and how this all works out. And I won't bore you with all the specific data. There's a book that goes through some of this. There's first of all, the book that just has all the lists. And then a British scholar named Richard Bauckham wrote a book called Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, where he takes some of this data and fleshes out some of the implications. But what it all boils down to is that there are two really important things about these names. Actually, three really important things. First of all, they use the right names. In the Gospels, you don't have any Ptolemaeus running around, or any Sabbataeus running around, or any Dositheuses running around, because those weren't the names that were used there. And so they use names like Simon and Joseph and Lazarus and Judas and John, and those names match on the lists. Now, there are less frequent names as well that show up in the Gospels, and they match roughly proportionally as well. So first of all, they use the right names. The names that are supposed to be in Palestine in the first century are the names that show up in the Gospels in Palestine in the first century. They've got the right names. Secondly, they have them in the right proportion. The two most frequent Jewish male names on our list outside the Bible, and the two most frequent Jewish male names inside the Bible are the same two names, and there is only a 3% variance in how frequently they're used. So out of all the male names in our lists, they account for 16% of all the Jewish male names. In the Gospels, they account for 18-point-something%. So it's less than 3% difference. They're not just using the right names. They're using the right names in the right places in the sequence and using them in the right frequency in reference to the rest of the names that show up in the Bible. Do you know what kind of calculation that would take to pull that off? All right, let's, Matthew, I'm writing a gospel. Oh, that sounds great, Luke. Let's work on this together. We're going to trick everyone into thinking that we were there and that we were eyewitnesses. All right, that sounds like a great plan. How do we do this? Well, let's use the right names. Okay, that's a good idea. What were the top 10 most frequent names? I don't know. Well, you know what? I just happened to find a list here. They just published, you know, Jewish Quarterly, and here's the list of the most frequent names. All right, what are the proportions of these names in comparison to the rest of all of society? Well, these two names account for 15.6% of all names. All right, so let me go through my gospel, and I'll count every single male name that I have, and I'll make sure that 15.6% or roughly that amount is the number of times I use that same name too. This is insane. I mean, to create a fraud that is accurate at that level on that kind of incidental detail is virtually impossible. But to tell a story that you're a witness to, where you just use people's names as they show up in your life, that's exactly what it would look like. So they have the right names, they have them in the right frequency, and third, they have the right character trait of them. Now, what I mean when I say character trait is that they have a feature that shows up sometimes, but not all the time. And you know what it is. You'll know what it is when I say it. I'm going to use a fancy word for it. And it's a word you've seen if you use Wikipedia. It's disambiguation. Anyone ever heard that word before? If you go on Wikipedia and you look for something that's a common entry, you'll go to it and you'll say, oh, that's not the right one. I wanted the other reference to kite. You know, I didn't want the bird. I want the thing you fly on a string. And it says, you know, for other definitions of kite, see kite disambiguation. And it's the disambiguation page that you go to. And what it does is it takes something that is ambiguous and it removes the ambiguity. That's what disambiguate. It's clarifying. It's specifying. So something that is very common, you can know what the specific one that is being talked about, what that one is. Well, the Bible does this with names. But it doesn't do it with all the names. It does it with some of the names. Have you ever noticed that there's never someone who's just Simon in the New Testament? There's Simon Peter. There's Simon the Zealot. There's Simon the Tanner. There's Simon of Cyrene. There's Simon the Leper. There's Simon the sorcerer. It's always Simon something, because Simon was the most frequent Jewish name, Jewish male name. And so every time Simon shows up, he has to be clarified. Because if you walk out on the street and say, hey, Simon, 25 people turn around and look at you. Now, it doesn't show up when Jesus is talking to Peter and he says, Simon, do you love me? And it doesn't have to show up then because he's looking him square in the eye and talking to him. He doesn't have to clarify which Simon he's talking to or which Simon he's talking about. It's only when he has to specify. And here's the thing. The Gospels do it consistently when it's a high-frequency name, and they don't do it at all when it's a low-frequency name. How do you get that right? To know the difference on which ones you need to clarify and which ones you don't when you're a fraud writing 100 years ago and not 100 years later, and not just writing 100 years later, but all biblical scholars agree that all the Gospels were written from somewhere different from Palestine. They're written from a different place. So again, it's like you writing about France, not a Frenchman writing about France. And for that matter, I could write about Florida and I'd still get the names wrong. You ever have that happen? Or know someone that has this wonderfully original, imaginative name to give to their child, only to find out that 15 other children have the same name? And you just don't recognize it until it's a part of your life. And you've had that happen, right? You buy a new car and suddenly you start seeing them everywhere. It's not that that car magically appeared. It's that you had no reference point before to notice it. And now that you have one, you start noticing them. The same thing happens with names. You really don't have a good idea of the name frequency, even in this city, probably, to make it up and get it right. But again, if you're just telling the story, it's going to be right all the way down. So in the list of the apostles in Matthew chapter 10, Simon, the most common name, has a qualifier. James, the 11th most common name, has a qualifier. John, the 5th most common name, has a qualifier. Philip, the 61st most common name, doesn't have a qualifier. Bartholomew, the 50th most common name, doesn't have a qualifier. Thomas, not even in the top 80, doesn't have a qualifier. Matthew, the 9th most common, does have a qualifier. James, the 11th most common, again, has a qualifier. They really need him because there's two James in that group. Same thing with Simon when it shows up again. Thaddeus, the 39th most common name, doesn't have a qualifier. Judas, the 4th most common name, does have a qualifier. All the way through the Gospels, this is the pattern that emerges every single time, with one exception. Two, if you count direct dialogue. So as I already said, direct dialogue, the qualifiers don't happen because it's one person talking to another. The other exception is Jesus, who doesn't get a qualifier most of the time. And the author doesn't give you a qualifier because if you don't know who Jesus is, you probably have a bigger problem than figuring out which Jesus is being talked about. But there are times when it does show up. It shows up in crowd speech. The narrator never qualifies Jesus, but every time he quotes someone talking about Jesus, he does. Because that's what they would have said. Jesus of Nazareth, Jesus the son of David, Jesus this, Jesus that. When someone else is talking about Jesus, it gets the qualifier. And again, that's exactly what it would have looked like. It is absolutely remarkable when you look at this. You ever have a hard time remembering someone's name? Everybody, right? I think I've known one person in my life that just has a photographic memory when it comes to names. I don't know how she does it, but names stick with her in a way that I can't begin to fathom. My kids get birthday cards from her, and there's no way on earth that she should possibly know that information, because so do everyone else's kids. It's just the kind of person this woman is. She's an outlier in that regard. Most of us have trouble with names because there's no logical reason for a person to have the name they have. It's just a cluster of sounds that's been attached to that person. In fact, very often there might be good logical reasons for them not to have that name. But be that as it may, names are hard. Stories are easy. You ever had that happen? You're looking at someone, thinking about them, going, oh, I know this person's name. Their daughter stayed with me for a week and a half when her car broke down. And I know exactly what kind of car it was. It was a blue Ford. And what is this guy's name? You know, you've had that happen. It's awful, right? Stories are easy to remember. Names are hard to remember. But think about that. If the Gospels have correctly gotten the detail that is the hardest thing to get right, why should we believe they can't get the story right too? The story is the easy part. If they're getting the hard part right, doesn't that give you every reason to believe that they're getting the story right as well? Well, what about place names? Again, how well do you know the geography outside of your own region? What can you tell me about the geography of Florida? Probably about as much as I can tell you about the geography of North Carolina, right? Not a whole lot in either direction, except for a few places you've visited exactly. What towns are there at all? Small cities and villages, how many of those can you name? The botany of a region, how about that? The geography of a region, how much time it takes to travel from one place to another when you've not made the drive yourself. All of those kinds of details about the United States, about France 150 years ago. Again, it gets to be incredibly difficult to get this right. The Gospels, all of them put together, list 23 different cities and villages. Jerusalem, most frequently. Nazareth, second most frequently. Capernaum, after that. That's all 16 times and above those get listed. Then in the 5 to 12 range, there's Bethany, Bethlehem, Bethsaida, Jericho, Sidon, Tyre. In the 1 to 4 range, Enon, Arimathea, Bethphage, Caesarea Philippi, Cana, Chorazin, Dalmanuthah, Emmaus, Ephraim, Magadan, Nain, Salem, and Sychar. 23 different places in this region that get listed. And not only do they know those places, they know something about them. They know the geography, they know the topography, they know the climate, they know the travel time. They know what city in all of Palestine happens to grow sycamore trees when those things are not everywhere in Palestine. Very, very small window of places that sycamore trees go. Yet Zacchaeus climbs one in Jericho, which is where they actually happen to be. That's a pretty remarkable sort of detail for someone living somewhere else to get right. They know that when you travel from Phoenicia to Galilee, you have to go north in order to go south. It's something that one high-level scholar said about Mark. Jesus was in the region of Tyre, and he went towards Sidon to go back to the Decapolis, the 10 cities to the east of the Sea of Galilee. And one very prominent scholar said of Mark, he was not directly acquainted with Palestine because he has him go the wrong direction. Well, the problem with what this guy thought is that there was a giant mountain, Mount Meron, directly between where Jesus was and where he was going. But if you go north a little ways, there's a valley pass, where not only do you have an easier walk, but you also have a water source running along beside you. Now, you tell me who's not directly acquainted with Palestine, Mark or this scholar? I mean, obviously, you know the answer to that, right? What's really remarkable about all of this is not just that they get it right, but that when you compare it to other writings about Jesus from the next century, how far removed the Gospels are from those. You may have heard of some of these apocryphal Gospels or lost Gospels. If you're ever in Barnes & Noble and you're in the religious section, you'll see all sorts of books about these. They want you to believe that there's some grand conspiracy to cover up the true story of Jesus. The Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Mary, the Gospel of Judas, the Gospel of the Savior, and so forth and so on. When you look at these other so-called Gospels through this same lens, that's when it gets really interesting. Because the Gospel of Thomas mentions just a few people's names. There's Didymus Judas Thomas, which means twin Judas twin, which is not the kind of name anyone would have had. He's either Judas Thomas or Judas Didymus or Didymus Judas, not Didymus Judas Thomas. That's not what the name would have been. Then there's James the Just and Simon Peter and Jesus and Mary, but Mary is not qualified, even though Mary is the most frequent female name. In the Gospel of Mary, there is the Savior, who doesn't have a name. There's Peter. There's Mary, but we still don't know which Mary. When you get to the Gospel of Judas, there is Judas, but we don't know which Judas. That's pretty clear from context, I guess. Jesus, and a bunch of angelic figures that have a bunch of really weird names. But you don't see the kind of accuracy and frequency and accuracy of the trait of disambiguation in those Gospels as you do in the true Gospels. What's even more remarkable are the place names. Again, I said there are 23 total place names in all the Gospels. In the four canonical Gospels, there are 14 to 16 each. And they are all, I mean, if you put them on a chart, I saw someone speaking about this, do this. He put them on a chart where you saw the number of, and the number is different, but then when you do it as a proportion of the number of place names as a proportion of the number of words in the Gospel, it's a straight line across. It's kind of crazy how exact they all are in that way. But 14 to 16 each. The Gospel of Philip uses two place names in the entire Gospel of Philip. There is Jerusalem, which is a lot like me coming up with Paris. It's easy, you know. There's Jerusalem and there's Nazareth. Oops, but he thinks Nazareth is a part of Jesus' name, not a place. So there's one in the Gospel of Philip. The other 13 different second century so-called Gospels use a grand total of zero place names. They can't even get Jerusalem. Altogether, they get two right, but not really just one. Now, again, you stop and you think about this. People will look at these Gospels and say they're telling us the true story. And what I would tell you is that these second century apocryphal Gospels present a very compelling case. They present a very compelling case for the accuracy of the Gospels we have in the Bible. They show us exactly what a fraudulent gospel would look like. Not just in terms of their wild speculation about the childhood of Jesus, although that shows up too, but in terms of the fact that they know nothing about anything regarding first century conditions, first century society, first century locations, first century names, first century anything. They are filled with ignorance, not eyewitness testimony. And by contrast, test after test after test, the Gospels come through with flying colors. I haven't even talked about the politics of the first century. You want to talk about a nightmare of something to weave your way through accurately? You go from Herod, the king of all the land, to Philip and Archelaus and Antipas that are all divided up, to just Philip and Antipas, to Antipas and Pilate, to Herod Agrippa, to Felix and Festus and those guys. I mean, you're going back and forth from a single Jewish king, although there weren't kings anywhere, yet somehow he was anyway, to a split group of tetrarchs, to some Jewish leadership and some Roman leadership, to all Roman leadership, back to Jewish leadership, back to Roman leadership. You know how hard it is to get that right if you're making it up? That's a minefield of potential mistakes. And the Gospels and Acts weave through it perfectly without a single misstep. It is incredible to see how accurate they are all the way through. How do you do this? There's one way. You were there. Or maybe you talk to someone else who was there and you're telling their story. But one way or the other, it's eyewitness testimony, and there's no way around it. So can you trust the Gospels? Can you look at this and say, this is dependable, this is reliable, they are accurate in what they're talking about? Yes, I think you have every reason to believe that they're trustworthy, that they're accurate. Well, as I said I was going to do, I want to end with something a little bit more devotional and motivational, perhaps. I guess devotional more than motivational. I think there's something motivational in that kind of evidence for the Gospels. Well, I was gonna save this for tomorrow night, but Ken and I got talking about it over dinner, so I'm gonna do this now and do something else tomorrow morning instead. This is a story that comes from my father's childhood. Back where when he was growing up, he grew up in Northwest Arkansas, way up in the Ozarks up there, and it was impoverished, about as impoverished as it could possibly be. I mean, it was impoverished at the point that although he was born in the mid to late 40s, if I remember correctly, he was not born in a hospital, even though there were hospitals. He was born in his house. And he was born in a house that did not have indoor plumbing, even though there was plenty of indoor plumbing back then. That's how backwards they were there and how just poor that community was. And every now and then, on a very special occasion, my grandfather would take the family down to the corner store and buy everyone a grape knee-high. If you don't know what that is, it's like grape Fanta. But it came in a bottle. Grape knee-high. And that was their special occasion. That was their big splurge. They got a bottle of grape knee-high. And my dad got to the point somewhere along the way that he started collecting the bottle caps from those different trips. And he had this box that had all of the bottle caps in it. It was his bottle cap collection that he would take everywhere with him. You know how kids are, right? They get something and they just haul it everywhere, whether or not there's any sense in doing it. And he would take this bottle cap collection with him everywhere. And one day he was walking along with it, and he tripped, and it went flying, and all of the contents went down the register that let up the heat from the furnace. And you couldn't stick your arm down there and get it. And he was completely inconsolable. I mean, he cried and cried and cried, and nothing anyone said or did could get him to stop crying until eventually my grandfather said, "That's it," and he took apart the entire thing and got down in there where he could get the collection back and give it back to my father, and that's what it took to calm him down. Well, there are two things about that story that are significant as we think about it today, and I haven't told you what those are yet. First of all, this is a story that my dad only knows because he's heard his parents tell it so many times. It's one of those stories. You have those stories in your life, right? You know the story about yourself, but you don't remember it happening. You just heard your parents tell it a lot. It's one of those stories. He doesn't actually remember that happening, but he knows the story well. And secondly, now when he looks back at it, he says, you know what? It was really pretty silly for me to get that worked up about a bottle cap collection. I mean, even if it was mementos of special occasions, it's still a bottle cap collection. You shouldn't be inconsolable about a bottle cap collection. It's kind of silly. So now from his perspective, he doesn't remember it at all. And he thinks it's kind of silly thing for him to be worked up about. As he looks back on it from a more mature perspective. Well, what does that have to do with anything spiritual? Every now and then we sing the song, "Farther along we'll know all about it, farther along we'll understand why." And I think that's a fine sentiment as far as sentiments go. But I would suggest to you the Bible never promises us that we'll understand. And when you look at passages that talk about heaven, they don't talk in terms of understanding. They talk in terms of glory. They talk in terms of being in the presence of God. Job suffers monumentally, and in his great declaration of faith in Job 19, he says, I know that my Redeemer lives. And as he works his way through this, what he says at the end isn't that at the last I will be explained to about everything, and then I will know, and then I'll feel so much better. I don't know about you, but I have a hard time thinking Job would appreciate it if he knew. At least I know I would have a hard time appreciating it if I was told by God, oh yeah, I had this bet with Satan, and I knew what the answer was going to be all along, but you had to suffer to prove me right. I'm sorry, you're God, you knew all along, and you made me suffer? I mean, I'm sure I wouldn't say that to God's face, but at the same time, I don't know that understanding would help. And that's not what Job clings to. What Job clings to is that one day he will see God, and that will be enough. When Paul says the present sufferings aren't worth being compared to, the end of that sentence isn't the answers that we will get in the sweet by and by. The ending of the sentence is the glory that will be revealed. What if we get to heaven and what we find is not explanation, but that what we find is that by comparison to the glory we're experiencing in the presence of God, the sufferings of this life, the worst moment that you ever experienced is nothing but a collection of bottle caps. Something that you look back and you say, how could I have been so worked up about that? Something that you might not even remember unless God reminds you. Isn't that so much better than answers? I think that's what the Bible promises. The Bible promises that when we compare the sufferings of today to the glory of God, we won't care about the sufferings at all anymore. And that is a hope that we can cling to.